Don't you know we're talking about a revolution? Sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with co-hosts Jake Towne and Gene DiNardo. It is Thursday, May 10, 2012, and here are some of the headlines we're looking at today. This is going to be a very European-centric day because there's a lot of stuff going on over there. Not too surprising to people who are regular listeners of the program because we seem to be focusing on it every week, but it looks like the rest of the world is waking up to it more and more. The crisis that they thought was gone this past December is back again, and we'll be having a lot of commentary about that. Plus, we're also going to look at another crisis that may be rearing its ugly head. Remember the robo-signing crisis that was supposedly settled by the major settlement across the country? Well, maybe not so much. We'll look at a Florida case that could be involved with that. Plus, Jake's got some very interesting information about what's going on with the GOP primary, you know, the one that nobody's paying any attention to. We'll be talking touching on that after the break as well. But first, let's go to Gene, who's going to give us an update on the latest information coming out of Greece, where they have been struggling mightily to form a new government. Gene?
Yeah, they're trying to put something together here, and it all kind of they're trying to coordinate it with this loan to keep their government running, and they're having some problems. And the leftist leader, Alexis, I think it's Tsipras. He's the leader of the coalition of the radical left, known as SYRIZA. Syriza was given a mandate from President Karolis Papoulias to form a government Tuesday after the frontrunner Antonis Samaras, the leader of the New Democracy, failed to do so. So they're mandated to put this together, and they're having problems. Yet to the consternation of European leaders and financial markets, Tsipras held true to his party's platform of opposing the loan agreement that Greece made with its so-called foreign lenders, the European Commission, the European Central Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. He called on the other two dominant parties that backed the bailout, the socialists, which are led by Evangelos Venizelos, and the New Democracy Party, to revoke the deal. He said for European leaders hoping for a quick resolution, he said to them, the popular verdict clearly renders the bailout deal null. Such statements and the results of Sunday's elections, in which there was a groundswell of anti-austerity votes, have worried the country's foreign lenders who want Greece to abide by the commitments it made in exchange for the foreign financing it needs to meet expenses. The leftist leader has gone the furthest in rejecting the bailout terms. Both Venizelos and Samaras have called for modifications, especially to the time frame in which they're supposed to meet the deficit reduction targets. It goes on to say, still, if Greece fails to enforce the benchmark cuts and structural changes set in a second loan agreement reached in February, its lenders will withhold the next installment of aid, which it expects in May. Without that, it won't be able to pay a bond that comes due on May 17th or meet expenses past July. Horg Asmussen, who's a member of the executive board of the ECB, the quote is, Greece must know that there is no alternative to agreed reforms if it wants to stay in the Eurozone. If Tsipras fails to form a government, the baton passes to Venizelos, a formality since Tsipras ruled out a coalition with the socialists. Now, the most likely situation now is for Papoulias to appoint an interim government and call new elections in 30 days, which would kind of put things in real turmoil as far as their loans go. And Greece might actually leave the euro and leave it behind. It's kind of interesting.
Very interesting, and it's also very troublesome to the financial markets because they're now in turmoil over that very factor, which supposedly the bailouts are going to prevent from happening. Well, maybe not so much. And it's not just in Greece that the problems are happening. Spain is also in the news in more and more unpleasant ways. And, Jake, you have the details on that.
Yeah, well, we've been talking on the show about how the Spanish banking system was in a lot of trouble, and those over the weekend, our worries turned out to be well-founded as Spain has nationalized 45% of Bankia, spending $3 billion dollars, and they also spent $3 billion into a bank called Catalunya, I'm probably going to say this wrong, Caixa, which they then tried to privatize after spending the 3 billion euros, and found out there was no bids, and most likely because the bank is worth less than zero. You can't bid less than zero on it. And Spain, more so than a lot of other countries over there, really went head over heels into the whole mortgage mess. The housing situation over there, there's just an absolute glut of houses, probably worse than a lot of the other European countries, and they are paying for it because their banks are on the hook for all those payments that are not being made. And the government there has said that they're going to need to spend another 20 to 40 billion euros in order to help out the bankers. And that's just a preliminary estimate, which means that the final amount would be quite a bit higher. So there has been eight institutions also nationalized, which includes Bankia in Spain. And there's an interesting article also out of from the German side, because, you know, the Germans really would rather the Spanish do not have these problems. The German magazine Der Spiegel was quoted as saying that the Bundesbank has no idea of what's happening with the Spanish banks, since a lot of this stuff is a little bit under the radar, and that the German government is completely rejecting the idea of direct payments to the banks of Euro countries, quote, for fear that their money would disappear into a bottomless pit, unquote. And that might be exactly what's going on here, since, you know, what we've been talking about, whether it's the 10-year treasuries, which, of course, you know, the government spending into the banks will have some impact onto the credit rating, and the recent downgrades by S&P and many others of the Spanish debt, is, you know, making this just another situation much, much larger than Greece and much more critical than Greece to the European Monetary Union.
Yeah, that's true. And in fact, there was an article that appeared in the Financial Times today, had another interesting twist on the Spanish banking situation. The headline tells it all: Madrid's central banker blamed for woes. I'm just going to read a little bit from it. Spain's ruling party attacked the country's central banker on Thursday, accusing him of failing to manage the forced consolidation of Spain's banks in response to the financial crisis. And the remarks followed the 4.5 billion euro partial nationalization of Bankia on Wednesday and sparked claims that politicians were seeking to scapegoat for the banking crisis, seeking a scapegoat for the banking crisis. Reading further down, there is a governor of the Bank of Spain that, despite being able to count on some magnificent professionals, has not done a good job, according to Mr. Martinez Puyate. That's what he said in an interview with Madrid Regional Television. He accused the Bank of Spain of forcing inappropriate mergers, resulting in Bankia's nationalization. And this article just goes on and on with everybody pointing fingers. One thing you can always count on, when everyone starts pointing fingers at the central bank and the politicians are pointing fingers at each other, the crisis is upon you. This isn't something that is building. The crisis is now here in Spain. And if you read through the headlines around the world, the headlines aren't reflecting that. But the fact that these kinds of finger-pointing are going on, you can bet the crisis is upon us.
You know, I was listening, I was actually listening and reading Warren Buffett's comments, and he was basically bragging about what a great job, you know, Bernanke and the U.S. has done. You know, we don't have this situation that they have in Europe now. We've fixed our banks. But all these countries, correct me if I'm wrong, but Spain and Greece, they don't have the liberty of printing money since they're tied to the euro. Isn't that correct?
Not correct.
Yeah, it's done in a different way. The way that they print money in the European Monetary Union. And I have to go back to my readings from the Tragedy of the Euro, which is a free book available on Mises.org by Dr. Philip Bagus. But the way it goes is the banks buy these national bonds, so it's sort of similar to the U.S., but then They put them up as collateral with the central bank, and the central bank allows them to lend out whatever else, and then that goes on in the banking system. So it's just done a little bit differently than here in the United States.
Right.
The principle is the same. The principle of how fiat money is created is the same everywhere, and it's certainly true for the European Union. All that is really different, as the way Jake just described, is the method for essentially justifying that monetary creation in a way that the financial circles will accept it.
Well, yeah, it's sort of like the shell game that the charlatans use at amusement park to pick which cup the bean is under. The U.S. uses cups and the EU uses coconut shells or something.
Oh, good grief! Well, unfortunately, it's not just Greece and Spain that are having problems, because it also turns out that France just finished an election and the socialists took power there, and now there is some possible fallout from that. Jake, what are we looking at in France?
Well, S&P and the other rating agencies did issue statements surrounding the defeat of Sarkozy by Socialist Party member Francis Hollande. However, they did not issue any downgrades. They just said that, based on, but they did leave some forbearing language, which was to the effect of, in the event that, the political, they said to the effect that we are political atheists. However, if they make decisions, it might end up in a downgrade. And what they're alluding to, of course, is that Hollande won on the stance of allowing the government to spend more, and really for the French people, it was a decision between trying to go with austerity and follow kind of like the German way and try to keep the EU together that way, or to allow what they call growth, but what we all know is really just kind of money printing and continuing the welfare states over there. And the same thing really with the election in Greece. They had a party election that was voting out the incumbents and moving in people that would, in theory, prove more spending. So you are getting some new faces, but it's probably, and austerity probably isn't the right word for it. What they really should be trying to do is cut government spending in a fashion that allows the people to get through and allows the government to take the brunt of the collapse. But the government, of course, doesn't want to have that happen.
That's not going to happen.
It wants to protect its bureaucracy and all the pays. And, of course, as large as the government here in the United States has now become intertwined with the workforce, whether it's the industrial complex or the lobbyist system, it's much more so in Greece, a little bit less so, but still to a great extent in Spain.
And interestingly enough, as we're talking about this, I have a number of online chats that I participate in, and in one of them there is a British listener who I know, or who I'm acquainted with, who posted a message. He's listening to the program from Great Britain. And Jake, I think I'm going to throw it to you because I think you'd be a good person to handle the answer on this one. He says he thinks the conversation is cool. He wonders if maybe we could shed some light on why the rest of Europe failed to read their Economics for Dummies and thought they could have monetary union without a unified macroeconomic policy. What do you think?
Well, back to the origins of the EU, kind of France was driving for it as sort of ever really since World War II to kind of neutralize Germany, because nationally, the French have a good memory of the German panzers coming around the Maginot line to start World War II, and up until the Cold War, they kind of feared a unified Germany. So when that kind of happened and the Berlin Wall came down in 1990, there was a lot of movement afoot by the French to try and bring apart this monetary union. But part of it was also so that they could profit at the expense of the other countries in the union, namely Germany. And all the rules, quote-unquote rules, that they put in place to have deficit spending be contained at 3% and this and that were completely overridden, completely ignored, really, and the penalties that were put in place were also just completely forgotten about. So what you ended up was kind of a race to the bottom, because if you were a government, whether you're Belgium or France or Greece, and you saw these other countries spending more money than you were out of thin air and getting more benefit from it, you know, they're really kind of leeching from your people. So it would be, the impetus would be on these other countries to try and equal or greaten the lead over the other countries. And you know, Greece and Spain and Ireland were kind of like the leaders in that. And or I say race to the bottom, of course, you know, just because you print money doesn't mean you're going to get prosperity. In fact, it's often history teaches that the effort or the result is the exact opposite. You get poverty. And unfortunately, you know, that paper wealth that was kind of put into the European Union is starting to be revealed as, you know, what it really is, just a sham, a currency that's not backed by anything.
You're right. In fact, I think the only thing I would replace in what you said it often leads to poverty. I would say it always leads to poverty, because there really isn't an example in history where people were able to print themselves into prosperity. It just doesn't happen.
It can happen. It can happen temporarily, I think.
Yeah, it could happen temporarily. I mean, you know, the case of the United States is probably, you know, the dollar has just had an elevated purchasing power really for decades. And, you know, people keep waiting for this, you know, collapse in the dollar, but it hasn't happened. And part of the reason for that, and what might even be really the major reason, is that these other governments, namely China, but many others, are buying the debt. And they allow us to kind of recycle the dollars. They send the dollars back, and, you know, they have a future IOU from the United States taxpayer. And kind of like the show just merrily continues on, because in the era of the gold standard, and when you had money backed by something, when you had a balance of payments for, you know, whether it's a company or whether it's a country, eventually they get equalized out. But the United States has been able to have a very sustained period of, we send more dollars out, we import more goods, whether it's textiles from China or cars from Japan or whatever else. We get a whole lot more than we put back out, and that has resulted in really, I would say, an elevated living standard here in the U.S. Where I agree with you, I think we probably both agree, it's, you know, the end result is no good, and it remains to be seen exactly how this is all going to play out. But I think all it really kind of takes is these foreign holders of treasuries and the silver and wealth funds to either stop purchasing treasuries, which is kind of what China's done, or slow down, which is certainly what a lot of these other countries have done. As a matter of fact, it's a lot of the countries in the EU, such as Great Britain, that accelerated their purchases of treasuries.
Mm-hmm. I would actually argue that, I think you make some great points there, by the way, but I would actually argue that even the U.S.'s ascendancy over the last half century, or perhaps even full century, in terms of being able to print their way to prosperity, like you pointed out, the only reason they've been able to get away with that is not just because other countries have been able to buy the debt, but because the way the laws have been structured, it has been essentially illegal. It hasn't been actually illegal. I mean, the law doesn't actually say it's illegal, but the way the laws are structured, we are basically left with no alternative other than using the fiat currencies and using the U.S. dollar as the ultimate reserve currency for the world. Well, if you have a system where you are essentially prevented from using anything but a fiat currency as the base currency of the world, then yes, of course, that currency is going to gain a certain ascendancy. But I would argue that that is ultimately a temporary ascendancy. It's not something that is permanently sustainable. It may take a while for it to collapse, but it must collapse. And we just don't know exactly how long it will take. I would also argue that even within an economy that is the economy that supposedly benefits from being the reserve currency, such as the dollar, has been able to maintain within, you know, the last 1,500 years or so, they basically have played that role, and it's been a very privileged role. Even with that privilege, it's not like the benefit of that, if you can call passing along theft a benefit, it's not like the benefit of that gets uniformly distributed throughout the society.
Oh,
it's
no,
only
right,
a very small percentage of the population that get the major benefit. The rest of society, even within that particular currency's country, doesn't really share in that so-called prosperity. And once the prosperity ends up going away, which must eventually happen, they're the ones who also get hurt the most. So I would argue that even the kind of prosperity that comes from having a fiat currency as a central reserve currency for the world on a long-term temporary basis, I would say even that is a false prosperity. It doesn't really qualify in the long run.
Well, yeah, all I'm really saying is Americans overall have to do less work, and they get paid and purchasing power a lot more than foreign counterparts. But, yeah, you know, it is all kind of a race to the bottom. You know, we talked about here how, you know, the dollar just keeps buying less and less in terms of goods, services, oil, gold, whatever. The purchasing power is going down at a slow rate. You know, the question is, you know, why doesn't it move down more precipitously? And as a matter of fact, you know, relative to the other paper currencies, is actually going up for the moment, very temporarily. But yeah, in the long run, it's not going to work out. And the unfortunate caveat to stretching this all out is that you do kind of set up for a massive phase change as, you know, people or even psychological events such as a hyperinflation where people move away from the dollar en masse, and you can have a very serious panic because, you know, when you think of all the things here in the U.S., like you said, Walt, we're all forced to use dollars, so everything is denominated in dollars, whether it's stocks, bonds, cars, gasoline, everything, and to have that... if that ever were to get thrown under the, I guess under the boots or whatever, it's going to be a very chaotic situation indeed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of inflation, I saw an interesting article where Bernanke and Krugman were going back and forth, with Krugman arguing for more inflation, and Bernanke, you know, claiming, "Oh, we can't have inflation. We have to keep it, and we're keeping it under control. We're doing a great job. We can." And Krugman was basically arguing for super Fed, you know, just to continue to print more, even more and more money, and spread it out. And he said, you know, we should have, and he was using the government figures, we should have 6-7% inflation because then we'd have full employment. And it was funny to see Bernanke, you know, retorting him and coming up with these comments like he's this great, you know, he's this great keeper, keeping inflation under control.
It's even more laughable, too, when you look at the CPI, because, excuse me, the CPI supposedly has been showing, what, 1, 2, 3% inflation over the last 10 years or so. But as we've talked about on this program, back in the early 90s, the CPI, the way it was measured, was changed from the way it was, say, in the 80s and 70s. So if you were to do like John Williams at ShadowStats has done and use the old method of calculating the CPI, the one that was in place when we had the high inflation rates in 1979, 1980, 1981, where we're in double-digit inflation, if we were to use that same method of measuring and apply it to today's pricing, what you actually see is over the last 3, 5, 7 years, we've had double-digit inflation. Hmm. So, I mean... The only reason that they made the change, they claim that they made the change because it, in the way that they measure the CPI, because it would provide a more even-handed presentation of what's actually going on with the economy. The actual reason they made the change in how you measure the CPI was so that they could cover up large changes in pricing just by changing the way that you report the numbers. So it's a really fascinating thing to watch what has happened over the years. Basically, with the economy and the financial people buying into what is essentially a lie.
Right, and an even bigger part of that, too, is all the Social Security and federal worker salaries and pension and benefits payments are indexed to the CPI number. So, it's obvious, I think the last time I think Social Security officially went bankrupt was like under Reagan, 1981, and what they ended up doing was increasing the FICA taxes that are taken for anyone's paychecks to, where it is now, which I think is 15.3%, although they took away a little bit of that temporarily for the recession. But, you know, and that's something I don't think we've talked about here yet, but earlier or last month in April, the Social Security Administration came out with a report saying that the major portion of that fund will be exhausted in 2033, which is 3 years faster than they anticipated in 2011.
it's interesting. Go ahead, Jake.
And also that the disability insurance portion of that, forget how many Americans, but it's a whole bunch, will run out in 2016. So that's really kind of coming up. So you know, these by the government being able to fiddle around with the inflation numbers, it helps out and kind of elongates you know, the payback period, as well as all the people that paid in, they're really being robbed because they're being paid back in dollars that are worth less than the dollars that they would have paid in. They would have been better off you know, taking the money and saving it themselves in a bank or spending it on something, another currency or gold. Go ahead, Gene.
You know, the I've always wondered about the Social Security calculations. Like, they come out with these exact years and dates when it's going to be exhausted, and yet they have this surplus fund, which currently I think is the Social Security surplus fund, which is the extra money. Like, I think this year they didn't actually save any money; they paid everything out. But normally there's extra money collected and paid out so far, and so they have a surplus fund that's basically $3 trillion. And in this surplus fund sits these certificates from the U.S. government saying they're actually called special treasury certificates or notes that they will pay back. They've already took the money and spent it, and they will pay it back, but it cannot. It's not a marketable certificate, and that it's called a special certificate. It can only be paid back by the taxpayer. Now, how do they use that in their calculations? They come up with these exact years, yet they have $3 trillion in the surplus fund. But the only way it can be paid back is by higher taxes.
And the answer is they use it any way they want to.
Yeah, or print the money, right.
It is a slush fund, and they say that they take the money and, you know, quote-unquote, invest it in treasuries or whatever, but, you know, what really happens
the government's
getting it and spending it. So it is, like, you know, it is quite a bit of a shell game, and the way that they do the finances for Social Security is really not fair. What it really kind of means is that you know, by 2033, every cent that goes out in benefits is going to be coming from someone else's paycheck that year. So when we finally get to that period, you know, all the money that they've stolen, or sorry, taxed, all the money that they've taxed in previous years will have run out, and it'll just literally be, you know, a redistribution from the workers, everything that they own in the year, you know, 2030 or whatever ends up being. All the money that taken from the workers is going to go directly to the retirees, and there won't be any you know, way to avoid the, as they have till now, you know, this slush spending. So, yeah, the money's already kind of been spent.
So it actually might hurt.
We can't tell the people that.
it might hurt other departments of the government rather than Social Security, since they're the ones spending the surplus. So.
Well, that's the nice thing about being the government, because you can just push the numbers around all you want, any way you want, until they come out the way you want them to, you know.
Yeah, and then tell the people, hey, everything's okay.
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, have you guys noticed how over the years, Gene, you mentioned the calculation that they do about how many years before Social Security goes bankrupt or how many years before Medicare goes bankrupt. And I can remember, you know, 5, 6, 7 years ago, something like that, it was 2021. That was going to be the year that Social Security was going to go bankrupt. And then it was 2018. And then 2017, and then 2015. Notice how it keeps coming closer and closer and closer.
Tomorrow.
Yeah, well, this is interesting. Also, from the trustees report, they projected that the OASDI, which is really, you know, stands for Old Age and Survivors Insurance and Disability Insurance, that fund, that program cost will exceed its what they call income in 2012 and will remain higher throughout the remainder of the 75-year period. So really kind of what they're saying is that, yeah, the gig is up. I would say maybe 20 years ago, what's happening this year is what they were telling the public, oh, that's when things are going to break apart. That's when things are going to break apart. And like all bureaucracies, they want to self-perpetuate, so they just keep on coming up with, you know, ways to kind of push things back. And the end result is, you know, you're not going to be able to get away from this. You know, people on Social Security are going to be punished because the dollars that they get are going to be worth far less than the dollars that they put in. There's really no way around that, because even if you go out to 2030, where, you know, you'll have another generation really starting to retire, and you just take, even if you just use 3% inflation a year, which is probably far understated, you're going to be left with jack at the end of the road.
Well, we like to self-perpetuate here on the Freedom News Hour, but unfortunately we do have to take a break periodically, so let's do that, and then after the break we'll talk a little bit about what's going on domestically, including the robot signing crisis, the FDIC, GOP primary, and more. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we will be right back. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and we were talking a lot about Europe before the break. We've got one more story, actually just two little notes to get in before we go on to the domestic issues. First, we were talking about Greece at the top of the hour, and I saw an interesting note that said that the Greek credit ratings may actually be lower than they are right now. I mean, we were pretty much under the impression that they were junk status, but apparently there are different levels of junk status, so it looks like Greece may reach a lower level of junk status. Who knew that could happen? And the other thing we wanted to touch on before we leave Europe is, Gene, you have a good report about what's been going on in Egypt, which, of course, is not necessarily related to financial crisis, but it is very troubling nonetheless.
Yeah, it is troubling because they're trying to transition from the former dictatorship to a sort of a democracy, and they're having problems because basically the army has all the guns and they don't know if they're going to give up power. But this is from the Associated Press. I'll read a little bit from it. Military prosecutors ordered the detention of 300 protesters on accusations of attacking troops and disrupting public order during violent clashes outside Egypt's defense ministry. The Friday skirmishes were some of the worst near the headquarters of the country's ruling generals and come 3 weeks before Egyptians are to head to the polls to vote in a landmark presidential election to see who will head the country after the ouster of Mubarak last year. As the May 23rd election approaches, many Egyptians are worried that the military council that assumed power following Mubarak will not hand over power to a civilian government. The protesters at the defense ministry were demanding the military council step down. After plans were announced for massive rallies Friday, the ruling generals warned demonstrators to stay away from the ministry building. They moved swiftly Saturday to prosecute protesters who began to approach the building. The hundreds of people detained Friday will be held for 15 days pending investigation, the prosecution official said. They face charges of attacking military troops, being present in a restricted military area despite warnings, and disrupting public order. The detainees are likely to face military trials. The official said at least two of the detainees are also facing charges of killing a soldier during the clashes. The military council had warned demonstrators before the march that deadly force would be used against them if they approached the ministry. One warning told the protesters they would be approaching the lion's den. More than 300 people were injured by tear gas, rocks, and live fire. Security officials said 140 soldiers were injured. And part of the problem was there was a protest before. Let me skim down here. Yeah, there was a protest right before that where 9 civilians were killed, and there's just a lot of question because there was no action taken after those civilians were killed, yet here are these protesters, most of them not involved in violence, just going near a building they weren't supposed to be, and they're going to face military trials, and it's really hard to say what will happen to them. But so there's many problems, And basically it's a problem that the military, which has had incredible power for so long, is probably it's going to be interesting to watch to see if they actually give up power.
Yeah, that's going to be an ongoing struggle. And the way I see it, it doesn't look like it's going to work out nicely, regardless of which side takes control, because it doesn't look like either side are going to be taking steps in favor of freedom or democracy or anything like that. So it's almost like watching a Greek tragedy. Oh, wait a minute. No, Greece is another tragedy. Sorry.
Egyptian tragedy. But
Egyptian
yeah,
tragedy.
The one thing to keep in mind is that the United States has funded really directly the Egyptian military. We're at the time that they kicked Mubarak out, very close ties between the Egyptian military and the U.S. military. And so kind of sort of by proxy, one of our pseudo-armies that we've paid for is running Egypt, which isn't good, but that's kind of how
running it
into
the ground,
happens.
Yeah. Well, once they get the guns,
And it's interesting you bring up the guns because, Jake, you passed me a note that's directly related to this. The whole question of U.S. defense spending came up in a House tussle this week, and it came up in a way that most people are not used to seeing. What exactly happened?
Right. Well, when if you recall, like the last August struggles, and where the U.S. bond rating was rejected, and they created a super committee, and the super committee was supposed to have two or three months to figure stuff out. And when November came, it was no big surprise when the super committee completely failed and didn't do anything. But what they had written into the legislation that increased the debt ceiling was that if the super committee did fail, that there would be mandatory cuts to go in, like actual cuts in spending, which is something that all congressmen, both from the Republican and Democratic Party, with very few exceptions, will not allow. So what the Republicans and this headline from Bloomberg is kind of really from the Democratic Party slant on things. I'll read the headline is, quote, House votes to cut food stamps to avoid defense reduction, unquote. So that is what it was, is the Republicans pushed through 218 to 199 a plan to cut $310 billion in spending from domestic spending in order to replace the automatic defense spending reductions that both parties have agreed to from that the super committee bill. But the plan isn't by the Republicans to actually have a split. It's just to get the money to the military so they don't have any really drop in revenue that they can, well, I guess, tax money really for them to use, and instead get the spending back by passing another bill at a later date, and obviously what the article writes is this bill is going to fall and fail the Democratic Senate very quickly. It was just kind of a political move at this point, but the Democrats and that are quoted in the article are just all about, let's increase taxes on the billionaires and the Exxon Mobils and what have you, and that's kind of like their party line, and that wouldn't result in any cuts either. So both sides don't want cuts. One side just says, well, you guys are cutting food stamps to avoid defense reduction, and the Republican stance would be, well, we're not going to really cut it at all. We need to pass another bill after this one. So it's
such a silly thing, a silly comparison to make. I mean, it's not like the food stamp budget is even a tiny drop in the bucket compared to the defense budget.
Yeah, how much is it?
It's not even in the same ballpark. The only thing that I can say that it does make it relevant is if you stretch an analogy a little bit and treat food stamps as the government equivalent of butter, you could say it's the guns versus butter debate.
Guns versus butter.
But
Speaking of defense, there was they just passed a bill to send, and they've done this. This has been going on for years. $1 billion to Israel for defense, I believe it's anti-missile defense. But apparently, that's what they do. They they just write them a check every year and send it over to Israel. So Israel, of course, isn't the only country that we send money so they can build up their army, but I think it is the largest recipient of
or U.S. right. funds for
defense. And to make this thing even just more, hilarious, if it will, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, states is that if the bill is passed and you don't pass any further increases in spending after it, which obviously is their plan, would cut off food stamps to 1.8 million Americans. Then it goes on to say, well, you know, about 280,000 of these are children's, and they would no longer be automatically eligible for free school lunches. You know, no, there's no such thing as a free lunch. if you go to the SNAP and take a look at, 1.8 million less people from today, today the latest numbers from February is 46.3 million. So if we take that back, it would be 44.5. That would take us all the way back to March of 2011.
Wow,
the level of people on food stamps. So it's really it's just kind of a whole shenanigan. And food stamps is running the U.S. taxpayer about $6.2 billion a month. So that'll probably work out to about close to $75 billion a year.
Well, now that we're food stamped to death on that, I think we can move on to the next topic.
Stamped to death, yeah.
Well, we were talking for a number of months about the robo-signing crisis that had arisen, and recently, as recent as December, I believe it was, the attorneys general from most of the states announced a settlement with the major banks to essentially settle the robo-signing crisis, except for one small thing. No one bothered to tell the courts, because it turns out, I'm going to report from Reuters, read from a Reuters report on this, although it's in a lot of different news agencies, there is a foreclosure case that is appearing before the Florida Supreme Court that could basically wreck what was agreed to in that settlement. Let me read from the article. The Florida Supreme Court is set to hear oral arguments Thursday in a lawsuit that could undo hundreds of thousands of foreclosures and open up banks to severe financial liabilities in the state where they face the bulk of their foreclosure fraud litigation. The court is deciding whether banks who used fraudulent documents to file foreclosure lawsuits can dismiss the cases and refile them later with different paperwork. The decision, which may take up to 8 months to render, could affect hundreds of thousands of homeowners in Florida and could also influence judges in the other 26 states that require lawsuits in foreclosures. Of all the foreclosure filings in those states, 63%, a total of 138,288, are concentrated in five states, according to RealtyTrack. Now, those numbers don't actually sound all that large. I mean, on one hand, they do sound large. On another hand, compared to the number of cases of foreclosure that have gone on over the last few years, it doesn't sound large. But you have to remember two things. First, Florida, as the article points out, is one of the major centers for a large portion of the foreclosure traffic that has happened since the financial crisis hit in 2008. And second, it's a big enough state that Florida Supreme Court law has in the past, on numerous occasions, established precedents that were actually carried over by other state Supreme Courts and have even influenced federal U.S. Supreme Court rulings. So just the fact that this is appearing in that state at this time, very shortly after the settlement happened, means this whole ballgame could be starting all over again. Well, we also have other things that have been going on in this country, including what's been going on with a non-political race. At least that's the way the media have been reporting it. That's the GOP primaries. But the Paul campaign doesn't seem to think of it that way, and we've talked about that in the past. But Jake has some more details about what's been going on in that little foray.
Right, and again, for our listeners, just because you win a state, and Mitt Romney is continuing to win all the states really since Santorum and Gingrich dropped out, doesn't you need to secure the popular vote? Does not mean that you get the votes at the convention. It depends on the state. Many states, I would say most states, have a the party gets to decide exactly who the delegates are. Usually each congressional district votes as a block and elects delegates to a state convention and moves on to the state convention and then on to the national convention. Well, Romney really doesn't really seem to have that many diehard supporters other than the establishment, which could probably care less if it was Romney, Gingrich, or Santorum. Ron Paul has pulled off several victories the past week. The main GOP was not only taken over, but they also are sending the majority of the delegates. And Nevada, which was supposed to be a major Romney victory, has now, they've changed, I believe over half the delegates are Ron Paul delegates. I think 22 out of 28 are Ron Paul delegates that are supposed to vote for Romney on the first vote, or at least about half of them. But there's a lot of conjecture and a lot of people taking a look at the reading the rules, that they don't necessarily have to vote that way. Like, they might lose their party status or whatever, but there's really no vote that there's no rule that prevents a delegate from voting each way. And with the addition of most likely Louisiana, Louisiana, Maine, Nevada, which would and Iowa and Minnesota, that's five states, which is enough to nominate Ron Paul at the convention. So that's not enough. And again, when I say nominate, it doesn't mean that he wins the convention. He's actually nominated for voting on. So he now joins Romney as the only person that has the states lined up. And even though Nevada's might have to vote for Romney on the first round, that has absolutely no play whatsoever on the ability to nominate Dr. Paul. And Ron Paul probably win a few more states as a buffer. So he, you know, and when we've covered this story for the past several months, it's always kind of been seen as very difficult for Ron Paul to even get nominated at the convention. Now it seems that he has a very good chance, I put it at 90% chance of getting nominated. His chances of surviving the first round vote, you know, in other words, to have a brokered convention with debates and more than one vote on it, are probably a lot less, probably a lot lower than 50%. But nevertheless, you know, the delegate count for Romney continues to stay, if you take a look at what's really going on, more or less stagnant. And there's a website, I think, called the True Delegate Count 2012.com, which has I think a better picture of where the Republican GOP nomination is, which has Romney at about 600 to 800 delegates, which means if he has big victories in the next states, such as California and Texas, he probably still, you know, it'll probably become a little bit of possibly a moot issue. But if Ron Paul is able to pull off some stuff and attack Romney, I think it could change around quite a bit. And some news that was really released by the Washington Post through the Obama campaign was, and you know, it's amazing that this doesn't come up in 2008 or right now, is that they've gone back to Mitt Romney's prep school days, because you know, Mitt Romney has really for his entire life been a part of the elite. His father was the governor of Michigan, and at the prep school he is alleged to have picked on a student, John Lauber, who was being teased. And then after a break, came back. This fellow came back to school with bleached blonde hair that draped over one eye, and this is a prep school where they all have to wear ties and, you know, carry around briefcases. Romney said to a fellow friend, you know, quote, "He can't look like that. That's wrong. Just look at him," unquote. But where everyone agrees is that he led a posse, tackled this kid, and forcibly pinned him to the ground and cut his hair with a pair of scissors.
You're kidding.
No. And at a later point, one of these people that was part of the posse ran into the guy who had his hair cut, who I think ended up dropping out of school. And he died in 2004. And when he talked to Romney's old friend, said, you know, it kind of really was very vicious and kind of wrecked his life. I think he dropped out of school and what have you. So, and the article does go on. It's not the only incident, but because this fellow later came out of the closet as a gay man, you know, understandably the Obama campaign is pushing that very hard to kind of ostracize Mr. Romney. And quite frankly, you know, from some of his, a lot of people don't get this, but if you actually watch the Republican debates, of course he, you know, tries to come off as polished and polite and stuff, but a lot of the body language, when, like for instance, when Rick Perry was kind of a co-front runner, Mitt Romney would actually, during the debates, place his hands on, you know, Perry. You know, it just makes it very believable that he's a bit of a bully. And I think that this, even though this is, you know, a lot of people would say that this happened way back in high school and stuff, you know, this is just kind of combined with a whole rich persona. I think it's going to be an excellent tool, and you're starting to see some of the weapons that the Obama administration is going to use against Romney. And back to Ron Paul, if he was smart, you know, he would pick his own kind of realm of attack and go at him, just like he did very effectively, I might add, to Santorum and Gingrich and Perry at certain
times. Well, hopefully Romney won't physically attack Ron Paul.
Well, now he has, yeah. He doesn't have to really kind of go about that, but
he's become a refined bully over time. He isn't the overt bully he was before, you see.
Yeah. Covert, right? Boy, that's an interesting story. That's something. I hadn't heard that.
Right. And, you know, there's been a craze in recent years about, you know, bullying and that sort of thing. I think the Rutgers student who jumped off a bridge and killed himself for being exposed. You know, it's the person that he was back in this prep school doesn't seem to be quite the same. They also listed there was a teacher that had a very bad eyesight. He would purposely close the door shut so that this teacher would walk into it.
Your kid.
No, and he would just do other pranks and that sort of thing. And some of them obviously might not have been malicious or what have you. But
oh, Mitt Romney, you kidder, you!
You kidder! You're such a joker.
There is a little bit of news that we want to pass along. Breaking news: J.P. Morgan is reporting through a number of different outlets now that they lost $2 billion on synthetic credit securities in the last quarter. And Jake, synthetic credit securities—they go by another name, don't they?
Yeah, you know, it's not exactly like they put $2 billion under the mattress and then lost it the next day. This is. It really sounds like this is coming from their credit default swap.
Oh, there's that name.
Yeah.
It's popping up.
A lot of them, yeah. And they could be on mortgage securities. They could also be on a lot of this sovereign debt type stuff. It doesn't. I've been
the
trying to figure out exactly. Yeah, you know, with everything that's going on in Europe. But their quarterly report came out, so that's really kind of what drove the announcement, because under SEC rules, they really can't hide this. Usually when they have trading losses, companies will tend to hide it as long as they possibly can.
Well, we probably should give them some more taxpayer money or something.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's just $2 billion, but... their stock did fall about 6% today in after-hour trading. So after this let out, I think they were actually at a small gain today and plummeted over about $2.50 so far. These risks have proven, and this is a quote from the report, have proven to be riskier, more volatile, and less effective as an economic hedge than the firm previously believed. And, again, it's not really so much as an economic hedge, but they were trying to make risk-free or so-called risk-free profits by for instance, like J.P. Morgan has worked with like a local school district and actually got them to sign up for a lot of these. Interest rate swaps, really, but they kind of defraud them because they lose money on the school district loses money, obviously, because they're betting against J.P. Morgan, who's more likely
who's
to be
win
right.
That way.
Yeah.
And the second thing is that
you got to be really quick because we're out of time here.
Yeah, J.P. Morgan is also the agent, so they get money by charging for executing on the contract. So it's kind of a double whammy for a lot of these school districts that, and at least here locally, got highly involved with this firm.
And unfortunately, we have to draw a line right there because we are out of time. But Jake and Gene, as usual, it has been a pleasure.
Good job, you guys. Talk to you next week.
Yep, we'll see you all next week here on the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.